Grateful to be here, grateful to be sober because of a loving God. Hi, you guys. Thank you so much for asking me to come out. He just got me almost crying there. Then he tried to suck it up. Did you see that? He's like, just let it out. It's okay. There is a little bit of pressure. I'm honored. What a privilege, right, to be the last speaker at your meeting. But there's a lot of pressure with that. But it is an honor and a privilege to be asked to speak in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, so thank you so much. And I always say thank you for doing a 12-step call on me, yeah? Because you helped me to stay sober today. It was a bit of a drive coming up here, and I got to stay sober through it. and then heading back. All righty. Okay, there's a couple of things I like to do before I share, and that is my own little share. And that is that I'm uncomfortable. This is awkward. I find it very vulnerable and exposed to speak in front of a room full of people. And so I always got to get that out there first. I always say, if I don't do that, the rest of my share is going to look like I'm cool, but I'm not. And so that just kind of breaks the ice for me. That I just find this really awkward. So anyway, here it goes. What do you care? Okay. I do it because my life depends on it, and I do it because somebody did it for me. And I do. I think about that. I don't know if the people who shared from podiums like this when I was new, if their sponsor made them do it, or if they didn't want to, but they did it anyway. I don't know. I just know that they did it. So that's why I'm here doing it. I want to welcome our new friends. Welcome home. We've been praying for you. You're going to get a newcomer packet. You got one already? You got a little packet. I want to see your packet. He said, is that home? You got to walk around with the packet, read the packet, do what's in the packet. I don't know what's in the packet. but whatever's in it, it's got to be useful, so use it. use it. I always tell our new friends, you know, we have been praying for you. There's a moment of silence and prayer, and it takes place in every meeting all over the world, and I've been to a lot of meetings. And that prayer is for you. So, but for the grace of God, you've been lifted up and brought into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's not your idea. And you don't get credit for this one. You've been given a gift. And it's a gift unearned. We ask you to keep coming back. And don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle happens. And let us love you till you can learn to love yourself. And it's going to be all right. You know, I heard, you may not want what we have. You may not want what I have. But in the quietness of your own space tonight, you get to ask yourself if you want what you have. And that kind of switched it up for me a little bit when they put it that way. And even though we acknowledge the newcomer as the most important person in the room, and truly you are, I tend to think it's the coffee person because we get really weird when there's no coffee. We kind of freak out a little bit on that issue. But I always like to take a moment to acknowledge the old timers because I don't know where I would be if it wasn't for them. So I want to thank all the old timers in the house. Thank you for my life and my sobriety. I still want what you have, and I don't ever want to lose that. We need you. Thank you so much for suiting up and showing up and letting me know that I too can recover one day at a time, no matter what. What I say about old-timers is not only do you impress me because you haven't taken a drink for so long, but you also haven't killed yourself or somebody else. Because after a while, that becomes an option. And there's something else that I'm attracted to with regards to the old-timers other than the fact that you still sweep the floors and you put up the chairs and you extend your hand and you're usually the most quiet person in the room. But I don't know if this happens in your home group, but it happens in mine. What I like to see is how there are a lot of old-timers that have been hanging out with each other for the last 30, 40, 50 years, and some of them still don't like one another. There's something about that I like. I don't know what it is. I don't know why I'm attracted to that. There's a sense of appreciation. you know, just to watch them. Could you imagine? They've been hanging out with each other like 40 years, and still when that particular person shares, they all roll their eyes, you know. They've been doing that for like 40 years. It's trippy. And I think what I like about it is the fact that the patience, the love and the patience and the tolerance that we have for one another, and that that person keeps coming back. You would think that they would leave, right? But they keep coming back. And so I like that. So thank you for doing that for me. You know. I shared this recently. It's come up for me. I think about it often. You know, we were talking about Pacific Group. People have heard of Clancy. I think they thought a Clancy guy was sharing at the conference, but it was somebody else from Oklahoma. But it reminded me of this story. Clancy was taking a cake at the time. He was taking a 48-year cake, and he was leading a meeting, and I was speaking at it. And after the meeting, I said to him, I'm sure you hear this often, but you've been sober longer than I've been alive. I told him, I'm 40 years old at the time, and he was celebrating 48 years. And what he said to me has stuck with me, because he could have said anything. And what he said was that when he was 8 years sober, he had a lot of things going on in his life, and he was fed up, and he was tired of AA and the program and being sober, and he was on his way to the liquor store to drink. He was just done with it all. And when he got to the liquor store, he went to open up the door, and he heard a voice, and the voice said, no, Clancy, you can't take a drink, because there's a girl being born right now, and she's going to need you 40 years from now. That sticks with me, because do we ever think about that? That there's somebody being born right now that I need to keep coming back, because one day they're going to need me. And he could have said anything. You know what I mean? Because we joke around about the old timers being around for so long. But my goodness, if that story was true. I love Alcoholics Anonymous so much. I'll tell you, my sobriety date is March 29, 1990. But for the grace of God, I've had the honor and the privilege of being with you for the last 26 years with those 24-hour increments. Thank God we only do this one day at a time, sometimes 1 second at a time, 1 moment at a time, yeah? I'm so grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous in so many levels. You know, I hear that a lot in the rooms. You know, I'm grateful to be here. I'm grateful to be sober. But I'm really grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous for introducing me to the possibility that living life just isn't so bad. I hear people share a lot about the program has given them things beyond their wildest dreams. And before I came to you, I didn't even know how to dream. I didn't even have a dream. And you've taught me what that is. You know what I mean? To even obtain that, or to see it, or to know that it's possible. I get an opportunity to share with you in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. And if you're new, there's a reason for that. In our literature, in the doctor's opinion, he talks about a message of depth and weight. It is the only thing that captures our attention. It's the only thing that you and I can do for one another that nobody else can do for us. And I invite you to listen to the similarities and not the differences. And as you do that, you get to ask yourself some questions like, that happened to me, I felt that way too, and more importantly, perhaps this program can work for me. It's interesting, you know, in the big book, in the preface, it says to do that. And when I talk to people, a lot of people don't do that exercise because they figure they go to meetings. But it tells us that in the beginning of the book, it says, before you go on to the remaining chapters, we need you to pause. Read one of the chapters in the back of the book, one of the stories, and ask yourself those questions. And so I invite you to ask yourself the same questions. It took a long time before I heard my actual story. But man, I found the similarities in you guys. And it's helped me to examine my relationship with alcohol. Not yours, mine. For you see, the very first step in recovery, the very first step, is that I concede to my innermost self that I am truly alcoholic. Because if I don't do that, I don't need to do the steps. I don't need to come to meetings. I don't need to get a sponsor. I don't need to do any of this. And I am so grateful. And I always say I'm so proud of the breed that I come from, no? I got sober in 96-04, Crenshaw, Llano. I got sober in South Central Los Angeles. and more for me, it's just edified the importance of where God knew where to put me. The depths of those stories, man, I thought my story was intense. Half of those people coming off the streets of Skid Row or walking the streets of Figueroa, they're grateful to have teeth and clean underwear. To live in the depths of hell and despair and to have an opportunity to come out and an opportunity to live is just like amazing to me. I'm still fascinated. In 26 years that I've been here, AA still fascinates me. I'm in awe by it. I'm in awe by the faces in the rooms and the stories that you tell. The miracles that happen around here, it still gets me every single time. I hope I never lose the excitement or the passion. Sometimes I have old timers go, can you get any more excited? I'm always like excited and fired up. My phone rings like central office. I love doing the work and working with others. I was telling Kevin on the way up here, I was helping a guy do his four step the whole 2.5 hours. So finally getting off the road going, I'm going to get lost. So like, I got to focus. Just make a note of that. We'll finish it. I don't know how not to give this thing away. I don't know how not to do it. So I'm going to share with you in a general way. And sometimes I get tired of my own story and I get sick of myself. I share this a lot. I believe that God in his infinite wisdom somehow, some way believes that if he doesn't put me in front of you, you'll probably lose me. So that I always remember, no? My relationship with alcohol begins in the womb. So I don't have the luxury of telling you that I met alcohol later on in life because I went to some prom and I wanted to dance with the captain of the football team and he would look at me and I had a pimple and I was uncomfortable, okay? And somebody passed me a drink and it felt warm and fuzzy inside and all of a sudden I threw up at the end of the night and I puked and I said, I'm going to do that again next time. Okay? I love that story. I didn't have the luxury of that. My mother's an alcoholic, an admitted alcoholic and Alcoholics Anonymous, and my mother drank and used, and so I came out of her belly loaded, addicted, sick, and asking for more. And they gave me more. That was the only way to keep me quiet. That was the only way to soothe me. That was the only way to get me to stop crying was to give me alcohol, so that's what they did. I didn't drink milk. I didn't drink formula, water, juice. I only drank alcohol. That was the only thing that my body would not reject. Whether people can say that was wrong, that was illegal, social services should have came in, I don't know. That's what we did. That's what they did to me. And nobody made a big deal about it. So needless to say, my relationship with alcohol, my life as an alcoholic is a normal life. I didn't see a life other different or different than that. That's just the way it was. I didn't have to go find booze in the streets or at parties with friends. It was in my home. It was always provided and it was given to me. I don't remember the well going dry. I don't remember running out. I didn't say I'm going to do a New Year's resolution. Tomorrow's going to be different. Perhaps I'll cut down. No, this is what we're doing. We're doing this all day, every day. And nothing and nobody gets between me and my booze. My brother never understood the relationship between my mother and I and alcohol. Never. He never got it. I wasn't planning on changing that life. I saw nothing wrong with the way I lived. It wasn't a secret. I didn't hide it from anybody. Everybody knew that I always had something with me and that I needed to have it. So for me, alcohol was like oxygen. I had been drinking since fetus. I came into this world given alcohol, and I was administered alcohol my whole life until I got to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't think anything was supposed to be different. I always hadn't learned about the four food groups till I got here. My diet was always potato chips and chocolate. And still to this day, I'm very comfortable with maybe some beefaroni I'll throw in from time to time. Because it's soft, you know what I'm saying? Or something about it is I like beefaroni. I don't know where I got that from. Whatever, I like that. I had a lot of sponsees. I would hang out and they would bring a sandwich and an apple because we don't stop to eat. You know what I mean? They'd be like, oh, look, McDonald's. I'd be like, yeah, I had potato chips. You didn't want any? That was breakfast and lunch. Anyway. Okay. I always say that the only way I can sum up my life with alcohol is in a couple of ways. And that is I describe my relationship with alcohol as a love affair. It was my friend and it was my companion. It was me and alcohol against the world. We didn't need anybody. I always say, I don't know if alcohol talked to you, but it talked to me. And what it told me was that if nobody loves you, I love you. If nobody wants you, I want you. I got you. You don't have to worry about any of this. There are other adjectives that I describe, and this is the only way I can give your Reader's Digest of the life in which I grew up in. You say that I come from a dysfunctional family. That's the language you gave me. As far as I know, this is my family. We're Puerto Ricans. We're from New York. I spend half the year in New York, half the year in Puerto Rico. I mean, we're mafia. No, we like to say we're mafioso. You know, the Puerto Rican mafia. That's still my family. Where most people in AA are just so grateful to get their family back. I gotta kind of stay away from mine. Because they'll rub off on me way before I rub off on them. I can't go around my family talking about love and tolerance. I still crack up about that. Love and tolerance is our code. Let's pray for them, shall we? They be like, get out of here. You've been in California too long. Okay. That sun is burning up your brain cells. So you call them dysfunctional. No, they're pimps, dealers, hustlers, gangsters. No, they're all alcoholics and addicts, every single one of them. There's only four members of my family who aren't, and that's my grandmother, my brother, my cousin Petra, and my father. Everybody else are. Nobody looks up to them. We don't respect them. We're not happy when they come over. Everybody in my family dies from cirrhosis of the liver, kidney failure, falling down, cracking your skull, getting shot, or ODing. You're either doing time in state, you know, county, state, federal penitentiary. And in my family, there's a pride in that. There's not embarrassment or shame. If you go to jail for attempted murder or anything else, that's a badge of honor, no, and respect. But you call that dysfunctional. My mother's in and out of mental institutions. She's always trying to jump out of windows, cut her wrist, run away, whatever. Daddy left when I was two. I would see him now and then on weekends. I don't know. I didn't need to have friends. We didn't hang out with outside people. We were about being very secretive. The life and the world that we come from, we don't need outside friends. If we did, they're very limited. You know, I always describe, I got one uncle alone who got 36 kids. I don't need a lot of friends. I got 36 cousins with one uncle. And we have two mountains in Puerto Rico, and that's where we stay. And so my world is very small, and it's segregated, and that's just the way I live. But you call it dysfunctional. I didn't see anything wrong with my family, and I still don't. I think they're cool. They make me laugh. They're hysterical. You know what I mean? That's why I can't hang out with them too long, because my chest starts sticking out. Well, when I'm hanging out with them, I'm like, that's right. Cut off his legs, you know. I'm like, oh, I digress, you know. I have to be careful, because that happens sometimes now with my nephews. You know, they'll tell me they have a bully in school, you know, or something. Or one time my nephew said that he tried marijuana, but he didn't get high. You know, and I was like, who sold you bogus weed? You know, where he's at? You know, he was like, focus, Titi, focus. I was like, okay. So. And it does. I have to focus now. No, and recently my nephew talked about a bully in school. He said, I didn't want to tell you. You know what I mean? I'm scared. You know, but no, I'm not going to kill him. You know what I'm saying? But we got family. That's sad. Anyway. I did tell him that. I just thought about it. I just talked to my sponsor. I was like, you let him know. Anyway, okay, all right. I just thought about that. That wasn't really a good suggestion. Anyway, okay. The other adjectives I grew up that you gave me was I heard things like I was stupid, I was an idiot, nobody loves you, nobody wants you, get out of my face, you're always going to be ugly, you're skinny, you're a twig, you're an idiot, whatever. You call that verbal abuse. That was common language. That was common everyday language. That's the way they talk to me all day long. The other adjective you guys gave me. People beat me, they punch me, they spit on me. I've been pistol whipped. I've had knives put to me. I've been cut up. I've been hit with pipes, belts, kicked, punched, spit on, all kinds of stuff. You call that physical abuse. No? That's what you call it. That's what you told me. I didn't know. I thought that's what happens. That's what everybody does. I don't remember going, oh, my God, don't hit me. Please stop. You know, most of the time I was just like, you're not done yet. I want to finish watching the television program. You've been beating on me for 45 minutes. You ain't tired. Can I finish the end of the movie? What you think? You call that physical abuse? I don't know. That's what they did. I took the punches. I took the hits. That was nothing to me. The other adjective you gave me, people sexually abused me. They had sex with me since I was five, men, women, two people, three people. You go from room to room. I thought I invented, group sex. Again, I got tired of going from room to room, so I was like, why don't we just do it all together? But you call that an orgy. I didn't know. You know what I mean? That's what it's called. It's called an orgy. That's what you told me, right? And so I thought that was my idea. But there you go, okay? And so you call that sexual abuse. I didn't know. I didn't have that language before I came here. That's just normal. That's what everybody was doing. I don't remember crying about that either. It was like, who's next? Isn't that what everybody does? And you know what's interesting? Somebody has asked me, Teresa, was it a secret? I'm like, you weren't listening. If I'm thinking it's normal, of course it's not even a secret. This is a casual conversation I'm having in school. I remember going to my sixth grade teacher saying, my cousin had sex with me last night. I've been bleeding ever since. You think I should go to the doctor? I didn't know anything was wrong with that. And thank God for alcohol. Alcohol helped me to get through all of that. That's why I tell people, I wasn't present for any of it. I had no heartbeat. I had no pulse. I was detached and disconnected. I've been drinking since fetus. I didn't feel nothing. That's why you can beat on me all day. You can have sex with me all day. You can call me names. I don't hear you, and I don't feel nothing. Who's next? You want to get a sandwich? What are we doing now? Nothing crossed my mind. I lived like that for 24 years. At the same time, I go to Catholic school. I put a uniform on, a smile on my face. I say the All Father and the Hail Mary. I do my confession on Saturdays, and I take my communion on Sundays. I also have relationships and family members who are police officers, politicians. Ain't nothing wrong with the life I come from. We're into money, property, and prestige. I don't need to go to the streets to look for anything. We put everything on the streets. The very character defects you've asked me to remove around here, I was breeded on them. You cannot survive the world I come from without them. Yes, I am arrogant, egotistical, vain, selfish, and self-centered. I don't burn bridges because I don't establish any. I don't need any friends. I don't want to connect, and I don't want to bond with you. I don't buy rounds for people in bars. I don't buy you drinks. This is mine. You get yours because I can't run out. For you see, I'm an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic because I like the effect produced by alcohol. And I am restless, irritable, and discontent unless I find that ease and comfort that comes immediately with the first few drinks. And even though I admit that it's injurious, it don't matter. The relief that it gives me, I'm not giving that up for nothing and nobody. And I wasn't planning on giving that up. And I was not planning on changing that life. I don't recall saying I cannot live like this. I was like, I'm gonna live like this, and I'm gonna die like everybody else in my family. I invited death into my life. I waited for death. I looked for an early death. There are times I walk through alleys at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. I dare you to come up on me. I ran off with strangers. Of course I should have ended up on a milk carton. So what? I ran off with strangers, didn't tell nobody, just so I can go to a bar and, in Casper Inn in Mendocino, California. Who cares? As I said, I wasn't planning on changing that life. I really wasn't. So what happened to me? How did I end up here? All I can tell you is that at the age of 24, all of a sudden I became present for my experience, and I believe that's when things change. You see, I don't mind doing incomprehensible, demoralizing things when I am not present for my experience. I don't mind sleeping with cousin It when I don't notice. But all of a sudden I began to notice. And I walked in a bar and I heard them say, look what the trash brought in. How long they've been saying that? I can't tell you how long they said it, but I remember when I heard it. And I tried to laugh it off, but in here I couldn't. Remember I told you I never worried about burning bridges or establishing any? Now all of a sudden I wanted to know, where's everybody going? And why don't I have any relationships with anybody? I didn't understand what happened to my world. All of a sudden it just flipped the switch on me. Then I saw the look of disgust on my grandmother's face. How long must she have been looking like that? And then I noticed that my father stopped talking to me. When did daddy stop talking to me? And more importantly, why do I care? And now in the good old days where I can get sodomized, gang raped, or pistol whipped, and I go to the bathroom normally and I fix my hair, I put on my makeup, I straighten out my clothes, I take a drink and I go back out there and I do it all over again. Now I can't leave the bathroom. And I can't take a bath because the water hurts my skin. And I look in the mirror and I don't know who she is. I have been loaded since fetus. I had never been present in this thing you call life. And all of a sudden alcohol left me and it betrayed me. It abandoned me and it left me emotionally retarded with no coping skills. To me, that's alcoholic torture. Alcohol told me when to get up in the morning and when to go to bed at night. If I was going to work, if I wasn't. Where I was going to live, where I wasn't going to live. If I was going to work, if I wasn't. If I was in a relationship, if I was not. And who I was in a relationship with. It dictated every single area of my life. Every decision I made was based on that relationship with alcohol. That's all I know. And now all of a sudden it's not helping me to get up in the morning. How am I supposed to get up? You tell me. I don't know how to walk. I don't know how to talk. I don't know how to sit. I don't know how to do anything. Alcohol is my oxygen. And thank God for good sponsorship. You know, I remember when I came in here and I was like, I don't know this thing about one's too many and a thousand's not enough and the allergy of the body. I was like freaking out on that. And she took me to downtown Skid Row to introduce me to myself. Because you see, if you've been drinking as long as I have, my whole bloodstream is filled with alcohol. I don't need to drink a lot. So I just say, I sip my drinks. That bottle lasts me forever, as long as I had it. And all of a sudden, it ain't working and ain't doing what it normally does for me. I don't know how to live, and I don't know how to do another 24 like that. You see, now I'm walking up and down alleys and I'm paranoid. I'm sorry, people. I didn't take that class. I don't know how to do paranoid. The only thing that I can come up with, because I'm telling you, I can't do another 24 like that. I cannot. And the only thing that I can come up with was to invite death into my life. And I always say it's a cold thing when you invite death in your life and death don't even take you out. So where am I supposed to go? What am I supposed to do? I can't even die? I'm supposed to wake up to that again? I don't know how to change that situation. I'm pregnant on my fourth child. All my babies fall out in toilets and floors, all of them. My womb is always so polluted, I can't keep a child. To this day, when I go to the doctor, I'm always reminded how damaged my body and my insides are. But this baby's not falling out in the toilet like the other ones, and it's doing very strange things to my body. And you people are moving too fast, and the sun burns my skin. I knew that it was a bright light. I didn't even know what it was. And I wanted the good old days back. I wanted the days back where it just didn't matter, no matter what combination, no matter what I did, no matter how much I tried, I couldn't get those days back, and I was still present for my experience and present for my experience. And my head would just keep going off, and you talk about this obsession, and I can't think of doing anything else, and I just keep doing it anyway. I don't know what else to do, and death won't even take me out. And so we talk about being sick and tired of being sick and tired. And all I can tell you was that for whatever reason, I ended up in a church. After this long walk, this aimly walk with no purpose, no agenda, no destination, it's just a walk. And I ended up in a church. That's all. And I stood in that church and I said a prayer. I had no idea that prayer was going to change my life. I didn't know that anything was paying attention to me. All I know is that I said a prayer in a church similar to this. Except if it was more Christian. You know, they have the stained glass. It's very intense. You know, they're very like, oh, you know, when you walk in, you're like, oh, my God, you know. And I say, God, please allow me to feel the peace that I feel in this church inside of me. And I think about that moment because you told me not to forget my last drunk. And I ask myself, Teresa, were you completely done? Were you totally surrendered? I don't know. All I know is that in this moment, there I stood. Isolation, desperation, bewilderment in that moment. And the window of the grace of God opened up. That's all. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says only an act of providence can help a drunk like me. Yeah. But for the grace of God, I stand before you sober today. Seconds and inches. The arrogance to believe that I bought myself in this program. It ticks me off sometimes, but I'm going to go get sober. Well, that's fascinating. I'm a real drunk of the hopeless variety. My greatest obsession is to drink like normal people. I will pursue that into the gates of insanity or death. I don't have this thing about I think I want to go get some help. I don't know if I was done. I just know in that moment I stood and the window opened up and I said this prayer. I was desperate enough in that moment and the window of grace opened up and I could have missed it, but I didn't. And I came 3,000 miles from New York City after going to my father and asking him for help. And I came here to California because you have a tradition which is called attraction rather than promotion. And my mother is sober, and my cousin is sober. And I used to come to these meetings when I would visit in California. And I went to your parties, your domino parties, your disco night with the hot dogs or whatever, your musician picnics, like the announcements you guys were making, those funny things, you know, that you go to. It's very weird, but it's cool. I get it now. You know what I'm saying? I would go to those things. And I would drink before, during, and after. But at no time did I think a seed was being planted. I don't even think I was paying attention to you people. This was mommy's thing. Maybe you messed up my drinking. And when I was sick and tired of being sick and tired, I remembered you people. I remembered your smiles, your laughter, the warmth and the camaraderie you have with one another, which I still like. I like watching that and being a part of that. That gleam in you guys' eye that you have. I remember nobody ever shunned me or sucked their teeth at me or rolled their eyes at me, you know, because they could do that, right? Like, oh, there she goes, bunch of drunk, you know? Loser. What happened? You're pointing, that's weird. I dropped a tissue?
Yeah, there's tissue there if you need it.
Oh, for real?
Yeah.
I don't see it.
It's right there on the bench.
Over there. Damn, that's all the way over there. Okay, thank you. I'll be like, so hold on a second. No. Okay. I remember that nobody ever tried to give me a pamphlet, you know, try to shove a pamphlet down my throat or a big book. Nobody did nothing like that. And I'm really grateful that you didn't. Because I really believe that had you had done any of those things, I would have been willing to figure out how to die out there before I proved you right. And I detoxed on a Greyhound bus. And I arrived in downtown Los Angeles on March 29, 1990. This is my first time in the program. I like saying that. Because there are some first timers. Sometimes we hear so much about relapses, we think that's part of recovery, and it isn't. The big book tells me clearly there's a way in which I relapse and there's a way in which I recover. You know? In our home group, our relapses, we call you our scouts. That you go out and you scout for us and come back and let us know that it's not working, and hopefully somebody can scout for you I always say, you know, if we don't understand why the alcoholic goes back out and drink, then the alcoholic is in trouble. This is the one place that we should get it when it happens. It's like, oh, I get it. Because what's abnormal is that we stay sober. What's normal is when we drink. And so I came here 26 years ago petrified. I was scared. I was confused. I was lost. My lover, my friend, my companion, my everything, alcohol had betrayed me and it left me. And now I was present in this thing you call life, and I didn't know how to breathe. I didn't know how to do anything. And I didn't know how to function. I was so scared. How do you live life like this? And my mother dropped me off in the rooms and she left me there because you told her to. My mother couldn't help me. I can't listen to her. I could wrap around my finger and play off her guilt. I can't listen to my mother. My mother can't help me, man. She turned me over to the very people who saved her life. And I'm so grateful, as I said, from the breed that I come from. I'm grateful for where I got sober, the foundation that they gave me. I've been talking to the sponsee that I have, and she's a mirror. All my sponsees to me are mirrors and reflections, right? Every time somebody calls me and asks them to help me, for me to help them, I'm like, uh-oh, what am I going to learn about me, you know? I'm like, oh, man, here we go. And I was talking to her about how grateful. I told her, I'm so grateful listening to you. That I got sober with the people that I got sober with. That they didn't have the tolerance for the disease called alcoholism that is centered in our thinking. That they were willing to love me in a way that I had never seen love before. They began to love me until I could learn how to love myself. And what did that love look like? They set an example. They sat up tall when the meeting got started and they focused and they didn't let me distract them. They guided me and they led me to the front of the room and they told me that I needed to sit in the front because I have to listen like the dying only could because my life depended on it. And that I had to take the cotton out of my ears and put it in my mouth because my best thinking got me here. They said, if you want what we have, then you do what we do. And they told me the program is outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You too can recover one day at a time. You don't have to take a drink if you want to, more importantly, if you don't want to. The program works if you work it. I like the congruency of the message. I like the consistency and the redundancy. I needed to hear it that way. I'm hard-headed. My disease is in my thinking. They used to say, stinking thinking committee. Don't listen to the committee in between your ears. And I get to do with her as they did to me. You know, she would say stuff, I think like this, and I think it's the neuron and the transons and the dynamics of my emotional traumas. And then I go, no. She goes, no, listen to me. And I go, click. Click. No. I don't need to listen to your disease. Oh, Tommy says to tell me, talk to me. We'll have a real conversation when you get to step 10, because that's when sanity returns. Right now, you don't know what you're talking about. Your perception is distorted. You can't distinguish between the truth and the false. I got that kind of language. I like the way they talk to me like that. Teresa, you don't know how to live. You block from the sunlight of the spirit. You need to find God, and you need to find him now, and you need to hurry up, because you're in trouble. Just like I had shared with her, you know, she said, I don't trust nobody. I was like, I didn't trust anybody either. You don't need to trust me, but you can trust the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because this is where thousands of men and women have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And that book has always given me the utmost respect and appreciation and has been able to talk to a girl like me. It uses a language in which I can understand. And it talks to me in a way that it understands me. It says, I know you don't trust. That's why we're going to talk about what's in the foreword of the first, foreword of the second. They be breaking everything. I love that book. They're like, I know you're nervous. Chill out. Let me talk to you a second. Relax. That's how I feel it talks to me. Relax. Take it easy. I know you're tripping. Okay, hold on. I know you're excited. I know you want to get right to the solution, but in the solution, we still got something to talk about. Hold on a second. They gave me a sponsor. All I needed to know about my sponsor was that she had a working knowledge of the steps in the book. I love the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned them long before the steps. Principles before personalities. Your personality is none of my business. Just like my personality is none of yours. You know what that is for somebody like me who comes in where I was told my whole life that I was stupid and that I was junk and that I was nothing and that I was worthless And then you come in here and you tell me that my personality does not qualify me to be amongst you. That may not be a big deal to you, but it was to me. That I have a seat because I'm a member, because I say I am, because I have a desire, and you don't have to like me. You see, that's why I like those old timers. You know, they don't like one another. I like that because you get to both keep coming back. We all have a seat in here, and that we all have a commonality, and that is our only interest, and that we leave all of that outside the door. Your political views, what sports you're into, what movie you want, I'm not interested. First of all, I always say this. Look, I grew up around nothing but Puerto Ricans, okay? Unless you eat rice and beans and you listen to salsa, you and I got nothing to talk about, basically, okay? And I like Telemundo, okay? Do you watch Caso Cerrado? No? Then what are we talking about? You know what I'm saying? So let's easy if we just talk about a step. You know what I mean? What's in the big book? Then that gives us common ground of conversation. That sounds bad, right? I don't care. It's true. It helps me. It helps me to look past all of that. I had to do an inside job. I had to clean up on the inside so that I could find this power, so that this power now can do for me what I cannot do for myself. I've taken this program very literal. I followed the black on the white. I did what these people did. I learned about the disease of alcoholism to the point to find out that self-knowledge serves me nothing. That no human power is going to relieve me of my alcoholism. I wish you could. Oh, man, I've tried so desperately for you to fix me, but you can't. I need something greater. We hear words around here like cunning, baffling, and powerful, and sometimes people recite them when they do chapter 5, right? They get all intense. Cunning, baffling, powerful. And I tell people, do you know what that means? That's serious. That's very serious. I've been like that. I don't know. I talk to my sponsees like that. People call me. I'm like, I don't play with alcoholism. That's serious stuff. Cunning is deceitful. That MFR is sneaky. That's what that means. Cunning is sneaky. You don't even see it coming. I know what that is. Do you know what I'm saying? Baffling. I'm bewildered. I can't even grasp the dynamics of that. That's intense. Maybe I'm Latina. We're very dramatic. You ever seen the Spanish soap operas? I think it's that. You know what I'm saying? Because if you watch the Spanish soap operas, you don't even need to understand Spanish. You just know what's happening. You know, it's like, oh, you know. And so I take everything like that. You know what I'm saying? And that's how I was with my sponsor. You know, like I took everything in the big book like that. It says, selfishness. We must be rid of it or it is going to kill you. And I was like, oh, my God. It's gonna kill us, and we have to get rid of it, you know. I'm still like, calm down a little bit, no, but I've always been like that. I've always been like that with my recovery. Kim's shaking her head because we lived together 26 years. I'd be like that. I'm like, we gotta do this. If I drink, I'm gonna die. I'm gonna die. You know, she'd be like, calm down. I'm like, no, this is serious. It's coming to get me. It's a life and death errand. You know, I have to relax a little bit. And I tell my sponsees, I don't play. This is serious stuff. You have to go to meetings. We stay in the middle of the herd. Unity, recovery, and service. I have a disease of a threefold nature. I must treat all three. It tells me that I have a spiritual malady that must be treated first. And then and only then am I straightened out mentally and physically. Why am I stuck on that? Just do it. They bought me a cup that says that. Just do it. No? You just do the work and then see what happens. That's how I understood it. This is what we did. You want what we have, then you do what we did. It's in this book. These people said, how are we going to tell Teresa? When we're not around anymore, how is Teresa going to know what we did? And they put it in a book. And then I do what's in the book. And all of a sudden, I'm telling you, this has happened. I'm still tripping out on this. Okay? All of a sudden, I did everything in this book, and I started seeing something different happen to me. I'm telling you, it's trippy. It's kind of weird. Where all of a sudden, I did what's in this book, and then all of a sudden, I had, like, compassion. Espérate. Okay. I started witnessing compassion. I was like, oh, my God. You know what I'm saying? And then all of a sudden, I did these things in this book, and life didn't seem so bad. What a concept. My perception started to change. When I did inventory and I looked at the facts about myself, it says fact-facing, fact-finding. I get that. You know, you're like, a good business is going to fail if you don't do inventory. I be like that newcomer. Just get ridiculous and ridiculous about recovery. I hang around people who have passion and excitement about recovery. I like the conversation. I like to be around people who are like, I'm going to this meeting. I got to put up the chairs. I'm going to go get a cake. You know, like that rubs off on you. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm working on this step. Oh, man, I better hurry up. You know what I mean? I want to do that step too. That kind of stuff. And then we have fun and we go out and we laugh. And now when I experience laughter, I really get to know what it is to be present in laughter. I learn what it is to be present in sorrow. And I've also learned what it is to be present in laughter and laughing and crying. And all that is about living life, no? So I've learned both around here. So sobriety to me has been more than just not drinking. For you see, drinking is only but a symptom. And once you put the plug in the jug, I'm more in trouble than ever before. And now you gave me these tools. And these tools are designed for living. They're not homework. It's not exercises to hand into my sponsor. They're tools designed for living. So I put down the drink, and I picked up the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I needed a drink to talk to you, then I need the 12 steps to talk to you. If I needed a drink to sleep with you, then I need the 12 steps to sleep with you. There's a passage in there on page 69. It tells you how you sleep with people, if you knew. It tells you. It explains it in there. Everything is in there. And if I do everything that's in there, all of a sudden, I watch something happen to Teresa. I learned that God don't make no junk. I learned that I was a child of God and I deserve to be here. I learned that my name is Teresa and that I have an illness that must be treated on a daily basis just like a diabetic, and that is just as serious. And that if I don't take care of it on a daily basis, I'm doomed to die. For you see, insanity returns and then we drink again. I learned things like freedom, hope, serenity. I learned about integrity, dignity, where I stood tall and I became a lady. I learned what it is to become other-centered, to not think that the world revolves around me and I become a speck among specks. And that if I'm a child of God, so are you. You know, God tells me I'm his favorite. The thing is that he tells you the same thing. Yeah? As I say, I don't know how not to give this thing away. I have a huge list of what I think is wrong with my life. I have a physical illness that puts me in constant pain. I've been a caregiver for people who have died. Those family members that have been sober have died, unfortunately, and the drunks are still left. My grandmother died when I was 6 months sober, and recently my brother and my father, who's left is my cousin Petra in Florida. And so my family circle has gotten a little small. You know, because they were the safe people to be around, kind of, so it's a little lonely. I take care of my mom, that mom I talked about. She has Alzheimer's. So you take an alcoholic that just goes to meetings with Alzheimer's, that's fun. She gets to be completely irresponsible and forget. Anyway. So I always like ending with a couple of things as I tell people, you know, I don't tell you if I can do it, you can do it. I always say I think that's a little arrogant. What I say is that if this God can take a girl like me, unloved, unwanted, unnecessary, and insignificant, and he picks me up and dusts me off and builds me up so you can see what he can do. If he could take a girl like me, could you imagine what he can do for you? I cannot go back to that life. Every part of me knows I do have another drink in me. I'm an alcoholic. But every fiber of my being tells me that if I take another drink, I will not have another recovery. And I don't know what it's going to be like for you if you go out, but every part of me believes that if I leave you, you'll never see me again. I cannot go back to that life. There's no way that I can go back to that life knowing that this life exists. And so every day matters. It doesn't matter what I did yesterday. It doesn't matter what I do tomorrow. And that's why I'll drive up here 2.5 hours. I'll travel without a dime in my pocket. God is my employer. We have a staff meeting every morning. And I just do his work well. And when I do his work well, everything turns out okay. And so if you're new or in the middle or you're old, we all just got to keep coming back and we carry the message. Because you gave me a purpose. It's the same purpose you have. And our purpose is to stay sober and carry the message. That's it and that's all. Simple program for complicated people. If nobody told you they love you today, I really, really do. And we deserve to be here, and God don't make no junk. Thank you guys so much for allowing me to share.